The Dharma is all is, and then the Dharma is presented kind of in the same way to all of us. And that's something that I've heard before. But I've been thinking about how kind of remarkable it is, you know, when we have some insight into self nature, we see that that's not just my nature. It's not non-differentiating mind. But also with our differentiating, judging, measuring mind, in studying that mind, somehow we also know that that's not just my mind. That's this human mind. And so the teachings on suffering, they seem to be true for all of us, how we create suffering, how we experience suffering, difficult emotions. And so there may be ways in which we do need different things, and we may need different things at different times in our life. And the teachings acknowledge that. The practices that we're offered acknowledge that there are different practices. Some of us may have anger more strongly in us, and others may have desire more strongly in us. And so we may need to work a little bit differently in that way. But in a way, it's the same pattern. And so it's our job as students, if we are wanting to address suffering, because it's like all on that, right? It's all based on that, addressing suffering, right? That's the Buddhist teachings, and looking at Shantideva, it's like he's really assuming that, right? That we want to be liberated from suffering. Each of us, we have to find our way into the teachings, or find how the teachings are pointing to our mind, because they are pointing to our mind, helping us to understand our own mind, understand our experience. And so, since that's what we're here to do. So just a few things to get us started with patience. So patience is the most usual translation of kshanti, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's the Sanskrit word. And so patience, also sometimes translated as forbearance, and we'll talk about that a little bit. I looked up forbearance. Forbear means to hold back or abstain. And that there's some obsolete usages that mean to do without, which I thought was interesting, or to leave alone, which I thought was particularly interesting. To leave alone, like don't get involved. Other translations are inclusiveness, tolerance, non-judgmental acceptance. It is said that the Buddha overcame Mara through practicing patience. How is that? What does that mean? How do we overcome delusion, confusion through practicing patience? The Theravadin teacher, Ajahn Suchito, says pure patience is the kind of acceptance that acknowledges the presence of something without adding anything to it or covering it up. It's supported by the insight that when one's mind stops fidgeting, whining, and blaming, then suffering can be understood. So, how is it that we, what is it to understand suffering? Zen teacher Eshin Rosetto says, patience paramita encourages us to explore more deeply what it means to rest in and fully engage in the truth of each moment. And how is it that, you know, in a way it feels like the paramitas point us, kind of illuminate the ways. So with patience, practicing patience illuminates the ways that we are not patient, right? And so how is it that we are not in the moment? How is it that we move out of that? How is it that patience can show us that?
So we have to make this personal. It's no good to just sit around and talk about patience like it's some kind of abstract state of mind we aspire to. It's got to get in there. And so we want to start with inviting you to call to mind a recent experience of irritation or anger. And I'll just say that earlier when we were preparing for this, like earlier this week, we were actually thinking like, oh, maybe we could do something that would really irritate all of you. And we thought like maybe like some kind of technical glitch where like the mic is like screeching and you're like, oh, so that you would have like a direct visceral experience of like, oh God. But we decided not to go that route. We thought it felt a little bit manipulative. So please call to mind a recent experience of anger or irritation. And if you can, I'm saying recent because ideally you're able to actually get in touch with the embodied experience, the sort of the crunchy, gritty, edgy, uncomfortable feeling of being irritated or pissed off, okay? So take a moment, see what you got. Yep. Okay, great, hold it. Okay. Hold it, okay, good. I like it, it's like popcorn going off. The pan is heating up. Okay, so the question is, we're gonna ask you to turn to a neighbor, so in a pair, and to reflect on, you can share or not share the actual event, but really, can you get to what was actually irritating, right? So not the surface level appearance, but what's at the core of it? What was offending you, right? What's actually happening? Okay, so if you're not clear on that, maybe your partner can sort of help you winnow that out. And then as you're looking at it, and folks at home, Jiryu is gonna put you into pairs too. So you'll do this also. And don't bail. I know when we go into the breakout groups, people leave, but then you're gonna strand your partner because there's only two of you in a group, okay? So you can work with whatever uncomfortable feelings might be coming up and hang in there, all right? It's gonna be good grist for the mill. So the other question, what's at the core? What's actually going on? And then also, do you recognize a pattern? Is there any kind of, in yourself, like, does this relate to any larger pattern in your emotional life? Okay. And then finally, what makes it difficult? Would you agree that it's difficult, a difficult experience, a difficult feeling, a difficult sensation? And if so, what is it really that's making it difficult? Okay. So take a few minutes each, like 3 or 4 minutes each, and we'll maybe ring a bell in between.
Can I have that?
And we'll come all back together in about 10 minutes. Okay.
Can you repeat those questions that were around?
The question is what was in this experience of irritation, what was actually going on for you? Like, what was the basic irritation? What's the core irritation? Like, what's actually happening? And do you recognize this as part of a pattern? And if the experience is difficult, what makes it difficult? Okay. And if you use a variation of those questions, that's fine too. The point is just to make it personal and start to acquaint yourself. Okay? Okay, please.
Okay, raise your hand if you could think of an irritating experience in the recent past. This human realm. Okay, we're just waiting for the folks from the at home to come back from their bleep out.
All right. Okay, welcome back. Okay, we would love to use some of your actual experiences for as a springboard into this next piece. So anyone who is willing to share a little bit about.
The irritating or the angry?
Oh, you had one of each. Yeah, either one. Udo, I saw your hand. It'd be great to hear from you.
Share in general?
I mean, I guess what we'd like to, we're not just going to vent tonight. Yeah. if you could share at the core, let's go with this question. At the core, what was the problem or what was the irritation?
Yes, so we were just getting to this kind of universal understanding of our experience, because though we had a different circumstance, for each of us, basically there was someone who was impinging on us in a way that was some kind of threat, and it confirmed for each of us a deeper kind of wound with the relationship with the world. And like it was kind of tapping into like a the world stacked against us and no one cares about us, and so it was just this very small circumstance which to each of us was a challenge and was irritating and felt threatening, but it was not that the smallness, it was for each of us, it was just like triggering this sort of deeper experience of the world in general, or our place in it, or
Great, thank you. Let's hear from some other folks too. Unless, did you want to
say, can I ask you a question for you? Can you say a little bit more about how is it that it was threatening? What's being threatened?
Well, in my particular case, I was actually on the bus going to the city, and I was doing some work, and I had an agenda. I had stuff I needed to do, and there was someone in the seat behind me that started up a phone conversation kind of loudly, and it was interfering with that agenda. So it was because I was attached to my kind of plan and agenda, and it was being interrupted, that was irritating, because I couldn't, I had to let it, I couldn't do what I wanted to do. In addition, they were doing something they're not supposed to do on a bus. So there was like this should, don't they know they're not supposed to? So it wasn't the actual person chatting behind me. It was these other thoughts about it, which created, in my case, suffering. And then from there, you can continue the thought pattern to thinking, I'm too, I'm not fitting in this world, and I like, why can't I be more easygoing? And da, da, da. So it can start to like kick up, like a deeper, thought pattern.
And that's a familiar thought pattern story.
I'd say so. Like
That's great. And that touches on one of the really important pieces that we wanted to bring out early on in our conversation together, which is reactivity. So I'd love to invite anybody else to share, particularly if you can relate to that theme of reactivity.
She went first. There was a situation the other day where the dynamics in the house changed quite significantly and quite suddenly, unexpectedly. And I immediately, my mind went, WTF, and don't people know, and so on. So this was my mind reacting. I knew enough, or I've been in enough situations to not actually react with my mouth or my actions. And the situations almost took care of itself. But when it started to subside a little, I had a very brief conversation with someone in that dynamic, and the situation changed immediately. So I found the courage to say something nicely and gently after I thought about what might be important here. And it changed really nicely. And so for me, it reflects when I was sitting on the cushion and going, and then I could be nice to that and be gentle with it and wait till it loses its solidity.
Yeah. Perhaps one would say you were practicing patience.
I believe I was practicing patience, having read this piece of Shantideva and come up.
Yeah. Would you? Great. Thank you, Tisha. Yeah, you want to pass it to Juan?
Go ahead, Taya.
I say my reactivity like jumps in one of two ways, like, and it can definitely be like both ways that I can, you know, actually identify my mind and like see happening to some degree at some point, and they can happen within like a split second of each other. So I was just sharing about you know, a person I was with was I don't think my sister will watch this. It was my sister. sorry. She just talked for what I thought was too long. It was really petty, you know, but then my reactivity came out of that. And so, you know, everything like sort of, if I think of myself as like a little energetic blob, you know, my two things are right. I'll almost like try and like take over. Right? It's almost like, in a way, it sounds really harsh, but like almost like smother right now. I'm my energy is the one that's happening here, you know? And so there's that like aggressiveness, right? Where I can't just let her be. I almost have to like try and like physically like control what she's doing at that point, because my reactivity is saying stop. Or, you know, almost like when it was clear that that 2.5 second attempt to like literally control her was not working, you know, then just like turn my body just a little bit and then just like, you know, almost like make a wall between me and her, you know, and so almost like do the opposite. So instead of like smothering, just like completely cut off, you know, and just a fraction, just a 10 degree turn. It's like, right, I'm just going to pretend that you're not talking right now. So they're both pretty unkind, but that you asked about the reactivity.
And how do you experience the reactivity? Can you feel it in your body before their thoughts? Are there thoughts?
Well, I think that's why I'm using like the example of almost like an energetic blob, right? You know, so I can almost like feel myself moving and trying to sort of almost like you know, like freeze time and mold. In this case, Amy, you know, that mold her into the exact way that I want, like stop, you know? And so I think it like almost like there's a bigger me that's trying to do something. That's trying to just like put everything in the place that I want it to be at that moment, you know, or put that wall in the place where I want it to be at that moment. But, you know, obviously it doesn't quite work.
And what's hard about it?
How so? Like what?
Like, would you say that that's a difficult experience?
Like, I mean, it's not pleasurable.
Okay, so why not?
Um, It's completely isolating. Okay. It's really unkind in this case. You know, I mean, it's someone I love dearly, you know, and I can't just let them speak for another 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 5 minutes, 5 hours. Doesn't matter, right? I can't let them speak. It's hard then for me to cope with those. Maybe this is what you were getting at, I don't know, like to cope with those, like, oh, I'm so small narratives, like I'm so mean that I can't even let my sister speak for another 10 seconds. You know, that doesn't feel good that I've created a me that's very small at that moment.
So it's our reactivity, it's our reaction, and it's also our suffering. Juan, and then let's move on. Yeah. And then the chat, sorry. Yeah.
When I was thinking of, things that irritated, noticed one thing that, an element that an irritation can have that can really kind of make it easy for me to, you know, react to it, is when it's something that, you know, for coincidence or for karma, just happens regularly or like throughout my life, right? And who knows if it happens to other people, but I've noticed this like one specific one, and that is when a person of authority over me or power over me for through institution of, you know, so I'm official or not, because of their edge, their some affliction of the ego, I suffer those consequences. And, you know, oftentimes it's little minute things, but because they haven't worked something out, I'm the one that's going to get the consequences of it. And when that happens, the first thing for me is like, again, you know, because especially when I was growing up, it happened a lot. And and what's interesting about that, as far as where my mind goes or what happens there, is, I think it's what gets activated is this thing I've been working on, where like this expectation that things are always just. I have this expectation, and almost like an entitlement that subconsciously that nothing should ever go wrong. That is wrong. No one should ever be a dick to someone else, something like that. And then get away with it because of an authority. And normally what comes to a bunch of other things, I have an immediate reaction, but then I remember, oh, this is just my false expectation that things should always be fair. But for this one that happens a lot, I don't remember that. I stay on that false expectation and get this sense of righteousness. And usually where my mind goes after that is, you know, I go start daydreaming and repicture that situation or sometime in the future where I right that wrong or, you know, give them what's coming to them. And for me, I don't like that, you know. So when my mind insists on going on that fantasy of righting that wrong, I just let it do its thing. But at the end of the day, I think there's a sneaky form of sadism when your sense of righteousness makes you think it's okay to like tell someone off, and then you fantasize that it actually changes them and all that, you know. And some, but yeah, that's a big one for me, that they, when it has a compound effect because of all the times it has happened.
Yeah, thank you for that. And what I hear in that too is this really edgy piece that we're going to touch on of the self-righteousness. And like, what about when there is injustice, right? And your anger feels justified. Like, we're still the ones suffering. So how do we sort of get out of that contraction? And Shantideva's teaching on this is hard. But potent. So we'll get to that. Thank you.
Can we hear from you?
Yes, sorry.
So Miyoho gives her example of a situation where trying to get heard and repetitively not getting heard. That's her situation. And This is from Mink. Essentially, the agenda for our daily lives is being obstructed. Grounded in our selfdom, we experienced frustration and anger that our story, our self story, was being impacted. I'm going to read just through them. There's just a couple more. From Marin, things happening that we think should not be happening, self-protection against taking on other people's anxiety. From Kyuko, similar reaction in my situation where I checked out and wasn't wholly engaged in the present and was creating a story while things were unfolding. And the reactivity was to disengage and just not respond. And lastly, from Ryan, it often is pleasurable. I can see sometimes that I love the feeling of being the victim and the rattling, buzzing energy that I identify as irritation is actually something that makes me feel alive and reinforces my narrative about myself.
Yeah, thank you for that, Ryan. And you know, sort of to hear that in some of the different, well, just to hear that, right? How is it that we like, what are we getting from it, right? Why do we go back to the same stories over and over? And because we're telling the story, right? So like, why do we do that? What are we getting from that? What are we creating? And also just, you know, another thing that I hear in a couple of what people have said is that it feels familiar. It's like, oh, and so whether that's feeding us a story or also to look at, are we actually reacting to what's happening in the moment? Right. Or is it like this always happens to me. Right. And so like, there's more power to it, or there's more, like just to look at that, like what's happening there.
I wanted to just say a little bit around just reactivity to kind of deepen the pool a bit. Because while reactivity, we're talking about it in this realm of our suffering, it's pointing to our profound connection, right? That someone can give you a look or speak in a certain tone, and your whole being is completely turned upside down. It's like incredible. And so that sense of just how potent our unity is also this tremendous power, right? So when we start to talk about other ways of responding, or as we are exploring, what is this bodhisattva vow? Like, is it for real? We should remember, like, oh no, we can really affect each other with so little in such a deep way. Okay, so reactivity also is like connection. And then, you know, that side of reactivity where we sort of get on the wheel and keep it spinning. So the story goes, or now this is happening and da da da, and that quality that came up in a lot of the different examples. This premise of like blame. So this is the tough medicine, right? It seems quite obvious that the cause of our anger or irritation is this thing, the person, the situation. But we have to recognize, like, Buddhist practice is pointing to like, the transformation is gonna happen in your mind. And you are not dependent on external conditions for happiness or peace of mind. That's the radical nature of the Dharma teaching. And so when we find ourselves in a moment or an experience or a repeated pattern of blame, this becomes a really rich ground to practice and liberate, which is so much of where Shantideva is taking us in this section. And that Tosho touched on this really nicely in that example of just being with, when we can be with our reactivity, with that energy, right? Dio was describing that that quality, that energetic blob, and the sort of the feeling of not even being able, you know, like having to turn in order to contain some edgy quality. That's what I was feeling anyway, as you were describing it. If we can start to practice, so practicing patience paramita is learning how to be in contact with that really edgy, uncomfortable energy and not react, right? To just stay with it. Pema Chodron says, under our anger, there is tremendous tenderness. And you can even hear that, right? That feeling of like, this always happens to me. This is stacked against me. It's not fair. Like that's our like tender heart right underneath. So if we can let the reactivity sort of wash through without acting, which is just going to compound things, then we have this opportunity, right, to touch in with what's underneath.
And we have to be aware to be able to, so we have to be able to see what's happening. So Tosho, again, you know, what I heard you saying was that you realize you could see that you were upset, right? I was sort of fishing with the question about feeling in the body, right? Can we feel how, because sometimes it's first in the body, right? So mindfulness of mind, right? Let's see our thoughts. See what's happening in our mind, to feel what's happening in our body. There's the remembering aspect of mindfulness. And so knowing the pattern, knowing what's going to come after this feeling in the body, right? That the story comes after that.
Okay. All right. So we kind of were following Shantideva a bit, and we're looking at the suffering.
Uh-oh, I've got confused.
Patience in the midst of suffering.
Yeah, I know, but I wanted to, okay. So we have three categories of patients. I'm back. We have three categories of patients. One of them is patients like in the midst of suffering of ordinary life. The other is, I'm saying this so that they are excited to know what's coming next. The other coming soon will be patients in relationship. And then we'll bring it home with patience along the path. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So patience in the midst of ordinary suffering. So Buddha defines the kind of the simple Buddhist definition of suffering is not getting what we want or getting what we don't want. Incredibly, this encapsulates kind of the whole thing. And if you go back to your earlier example of irritation, I wonder if you can frame it in terms of not getting what you wanted or getting what you didn't want. Are you able to do that? See some wheels turning, some nods, okay? So the radical piece, right? So in our ordinary life with sickness, old age, and death, we are constantly not getting what we want and getting what we don't want, just as a sort of, and the periods of time where we actually get exactly what we want are fantastic, but they're fleeting. And Buddha said, like, this is just how it is. In our sort of dominant American culture, we've added additional suffering, I think, for ourselves by thinking that we should be able to line up and get what we want pretty much all of the time. Yeah. And it turns out that with this kind of stance upon the world, our ability to tolerate discomfort discomfort becomes a problem that needs to be fixed and actually compounds and adds more suffering. So with the practice of patience, Shantideva has, you know, several places early on in the chapter where he is encouraging us to look at the ordinary suffering of our life as an opportunity to practice patience and to refine our practice of patience. And that this practice of patience or forbearance is a practice of learning to be with things as they are. So, as we were saying earlier, if we forbear that initial discomfort, accept and don't fight with it, right? Take it as just like, this is life. It's okay to be uncomfortable. Then we can settle. That cycle of reactivity, that proliferation, which just compounds our suffering, doesn't take root. If it does, we can practice from there, right? At any moment, you can interrupt.
And so we encounter this in training, right? We don't always get what we want. I was thinking about the poor monitors and how in the Zendo, half of us are too hot, half of us are too cold, right? And kind of the practice of the Zendo, and I often say this in beginning instruction, is that that's not my problem. That's not your problem, right? To fix that. The monitors that's their job, right? And so it's our job to just stay on our cushion, right? And then we get to work with this discomfort, right? And of course, there are other ways the training happens, right? We don't get the service position that we want. We don't get the meal crew that we want. We get the service position and then we get a lot of corrections. And so, you know, there's a way in which, I can't remember who Shugan talks about this sometimes, and I can't remember who's quoting, but, you know, the training needs to have some discomfort, needs to have some rigor to it, right? So we meet these places of discomfort. So question is sort of why, right? Shantideva says over and over again, like, these are opportunities, right? These are places to, so that we can see how suffering can be transformed or how we don't have to create suffering at all. And to see also how we, how what a difference it makes, a world of difference, how we respond, right? And so if we respond within upset, in complaining, in dejection, despair, it's just suffering on top of suffering, right? But how do we turn that, right? How does, in a sense, it's like, how does training work when it works, when we're able to use it? That's a question.
Does training work?
And how are you practicing all of the, yeah, I guess like when you experience something difficult or edgy or uncomfortable in this context, like how do you turn it? Has that happened for you? Yeah, Kokoro, great.
Suiman has the mic.
I think what's pretty clear to me is that most of my suffering lives in the story that I make up about why whatever happened, or what the other person, why the other person is doing what they're doing, that I'm reacting to. But it isn't the suffering isn't in the incident itself. It's in the story. It's in the adding to it with my story about it. And when I can see that and drop the story, the suffering abates.
And when you drop the story, is it all just all over?
No.
Is there, so what's, is there something below that?
Well, I think that's when I'm practicing. And in a way, I mean, when I can see beyond the story and see that the story is just my creation, is that there's actually sort of a joy to it of that it's opened up.
Mm-hmm.
So I came for the intensive last weekend, and I haven't been in residence for quite some time, and my life at home is enjoyable. And to come back in and to not have control over, you know, the meals or the caretaking role that I get, and, you know, and so on and so on and so on. I was convinced by day two I was never coming back. It was not going to happen. What was I thinking? And then by the time I left on Sunday, I was like, oh, yes. You know, it's such good, you know, fodder. It's, you know, you need that. I need that anyways to practice patience, to practice with my mind. If, you know, I'm the yogi in the cave and nobody's there to irritate me or to, you know, tell me something unpleasant, that's fantastic. You can get a false sense of security, or I can get a false sense of security from that. My practice is going really, really well, better than perhaps it is, but there's no testing of it. So yeah, in every way, being poked and jabbed, which isn't really being poked and jabbed, it's all right here. So yeah, anyways, to answer your question, yeah, training is awesome and uncomfortable and yeah, all of it.
Can you like, why is it like, why did you feel great at the end of the weekend? Like why does it, what's happening?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the recognition. It's the recognition of all of that that comes up and the true practicing of the patience and recognizing where it was done well, where my mind was sitting with the irritation without reacting, and then recognizing where I was telling stories. And, you know, and some of it was retrospective. So it was after the fact, looking back, because in the middle of it, you know, I remember Saturday night sitting on the Dokusan line with, my mind was like a jigsaw puzzle in a snow globe. And it wasn't fun at all, but avoiding the temptation to like nail that down and make it into something solid, and then recognizing that after the fact, I was like, okay, yeah, it was really uncomfortable and it wasn't fun, but fun and comfortable isn't a quality necessarily of good practice. It's the sitting with that and letting it be what it is. That's more of an indicator of what is good practice and what is not, or at least that was my estimation of it.
It makes me think of the quote at the beginning from Esh and Rosetto, you know, so something about like when you're actually meeting that, there's, you're more alive.
Yeah. The place that I seem to be focusing now has a lot to do with where does the pain go? Which is touching a vastness. It's like it goes wherever. It can go 50,000 different places to some other place. And I mean, it's not here, you know, so the walls are up. And, you know, we talk about release and attach. It literally, things literally go. They go to emptiness, I think.
Yeah, like where was the pain ever?
You have to call it. You will have to call it back. You have to go get it. Right? You have to make it, right? If it goes, it's not like it's there already. What's there already is really big. Like, really, really big.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of like the magic of practice, right? Yeah. It's all... I wanted to, well, I'll come back to that in a minute. Yeah. Thank you, Josh.
I'm a teacher, and I don't know if you've had this experience. Students can be really irritating. and since I've been practicing, I've kind of tuned in more to those moments, and some of them are quite hot and like potentially dangerous, actually, where a reaction can really be like gasoline on what's just a match, you know? And one of the things that I've been able to do as a teacher that's new for me is in these situations is really kind of key into where the self feels like it needs to be defended and my over-identification with the role or the function in that moment. And asking myself what that's really about, and then kind of deliberately flipping the structure of the relationship and asking myself, well, maybe they're the teacher and I'm the student, actually, in terms of practice. And so what are they teaching me in this moment? Or what am I teaching what can I teach myself in this moment? Working with the situation, because of course they're not aware of that. And usually what the result or the answer is that I need to be a better teacher. You know, like I have to find a better solution than what's coming up reactively. And it is always about kind of letting go of the self that feels kind of attacked or disrespected or undermined or neglected, ignored, et cetera. So that's been helpful. That's been new since practice.
Yeah. Thank you. There's a lot in that. G, is there anyone from
So Sophie recognizes that what's underneath her stories is the tenderness that you were talking about. And Myoho offers that she kept on feeling that it's about, I'm just going to read it because it's easier. I've kept on feeling it's about when I can come back to the monastery. And after years, I found myself saying it's about how I welcome myself back to the monastery when I come in person. And the distress dissipated.
Yeah. So I would like to use that, all of these comments as a springboard to start to look at practicing patience in relationship. And, you know, in more than one of you has talked about the story, right? It's like there's the fleeting momentary experience, and then there's the story that we have right on its heels or as it's happening, where so much of the consternation comes from. And then Dyson's question of where does the pain go, right? When we're practicing and we stop and we experience that shift. So you might be familiar with this anecdote. I don't know if it's original to Joko Beck or whether she was repeating a well-known story, but she has an anecdote where she talks about, imagine that you're in a rowboat in the midst of a foggy pond. Okay, so your view is obscured. You can't see well. And this other rowboat comes and bangs into you, right? And the immediate feeling of indignation, irritation, anger that would come. And then the fog clears enough that you see there's no one in that rowboat. And what happens to that anger? And so this piece that we've been circling around of the self, this is, if we look deeply at that definition of suffering, getting what we don't want, not getting what we want, we see there's an eye at the heart of that, right? If we can call to mind those constricted experiences, feelings of irritation in the body, we're constricting around this sense of ourself. Yeah, this felt sense of ourself. And spoiler alert, Buddha Dharma is about that is just a sense that you have. It's just a sense. I've been hearing Shugen Roshi use that phrase a lot lately. It's a feeling. It's a very convincing feeling, but there's not a solid core there, which is why when we let go, where does the pain go? Where was it ever? Which is why in a moment of deciding to react in a different way, we can have a completely different experience. And so all of ourself, the people around us, the whole phenomenal universe is coming together, right? This is the teaching of dependent origination, is coming together out of causes and conditions, which are constantly shifting. This complex web of relationships. And so Shantideva invites us in the middle of the, or the early middle section of the chapter, like verses 25 to 31, to really use the teaching of dependent origination to start to see like all of these places where we see irritation and vexation, where we're driven to blame, we should start to illuminate that with our Dharma understanding, right? There isn't a person there to blame in the way that we naturally leap to. Or Thich Nhat Hanh has very beautiful and powerful teachings on looking deeply into any situation. When you look deeply into a situation that appears to be a situation of where it's easy to assign blame, you go back and back and back, and there's so many causes and conditions. Why any one person acts in the way that they do in a moment that affronts us or brings up anger is the fruit of causes and conditions. And can that help to release our reaction? Ajahn Suchito says, reactivity isn't the truth of mind. It's a conditioned reflex, and it's not self. Therefore, all conditioned reflexes have to be understood as unreliable and dependent on causes and conditions. They're not to be adopted as solid and real, yet they do happen. So we can't bypass our experience, but we can start to understand it, and we can use that teaching to open up our view. It also means that we can take a different response, right? We can respond differently, be mindful of our habits and patterns, and in that way, get a different result because we're changing the conditions that are coming together. If we see a pattern that we is our pattern, then practice is make a different choice, right? Interrupt the pattern. Don't do the same thing because you'll get the same result.
So that's a profound view, a way of in working with difficult people. When I was talking about training, I was thinking, that's the other. It's like, aren't these people really? They really are irritating, right? Right, all these people. But so this view of like, what are you actually reacting to, right? Shantideva says, why be angry at others when they're only acting out of causes, conditions? If their faults are fleeting and contingent, as all things are, if living beings are by nature wholesome, then why resent them as well be angry at the sky for having clouds? Right, it's like, it's not personal. And it can even be helpful to, like, there's a way in which it to let it be a little bit more personal, but to see when someone is angry, right? When your student is trying to like get a response from you, right? That's coming from, where is that coming from, right? Some other things about working with suffering in relation. Forgiveness, the patience of forgiveness. So when there is, which is letting go. And some of the things that people have said, it's like to see how patience is, true patience is letting go, right? Is letting go of some view that we're holding on to, some of wanting things to be in a certain way, of wanting someone else to be different. To see how we can, when we are hurt in some way, when someone hurts us, how we want to hurt them back, right? And so letting go of that. And also to look at that, Shantideva talks about that, like when to see that impulse, right, of wanting someone else to suffer, And to really look into that, there are all these ways that Shantideva is saying is trying to get us to really look at what's actually happening and the assumptions that we're making. And so I found that, like, I was sort of particularly kind of struck by that, when to look at when we like, do we actually want someone else to suffer? I was remembering this time, a long time ago. I was living here, and I was working with someone a lot, and they were really difficult. I was having a really hard time, and I went to Daisan with Myotai Sensei, and I just shared that, and how upset I was, and how, like, you know, difficult he was. And she was like, "Yeah, he is difficult. Other people have a difficult time with him too. But what do you want for him? Right? Do you want him to go down?" That's what she said. And he was actually, you know, there were ways in which he was a fragile person, right? And I was kind of shocked by that, because in a way, yes, right? And then of course not, right? But to see that's actually what I was holding, right? Also to see how there is a patience in allowing other people to have their emotions, their discomfort, their uncomfortableness, right? And so how often we're reacting, we're uncomfortable, we feel uncomfortable here because someone else is uncomfortable, right? And, like, can we just allow them to have that? We don't need to take that on. We don't need to fix it. Are we meeting others in the present, right? Or is there history, right? Is there a pattern, right? You see, I get irritated with this person every time, right? Is it actually what they said just now? Or is it that I'm just used to being irritated with them? I'm used to reacting, expecting what they say is going to be irritating in some way. So am I actually meeting someone in the present? You know, and Josh, with what you were saying, you said something about, you know, you can realize in the, you can see in the moment that if you react back, right, it's just going to get worse, right? It's always going to get worse, right? It's always going to turn into more conflict, breed more conflict. Pause there and see if there are thoughts, questions about patience in relationship, difficult relationships, difficult people. Mac?
Sounds good.
I feel like I'm going through waves of impatience and anger right now, that this conversation is really pushing buttons. Mm-hmm. Because I'm thinking about all the ways that I need to be impatient and angry sometimes, or at least I feel that way. A couple weeks ago, my wife was working out in front of our house in the yard, and someone drove by and yelled, "Asshole." And then a few days ago, she and I were sitting in our living room, and the same guy drove by and yelled, "Asshole." So we were sitting in our house, someone was yelling "asshole" at us. Well, can anyone guess why he was yelling "asshole"? Yes. We have a Kamala and Harris wall sign in front of our house. And of course, the second time that happened, I have a feeling I know who it is. I didn't tell my wife that because I didn't want her to get upset. But I what I was thinking was all the things I was going to do to this guy for calling us names and, you know, and making my wife feel uncomfortable and really committing a gross violation of etiquette. And so that's just one example of like an example of a, yeah, but what about this situation? I believe in the teachings, but it's a tall order sometimes. You know, sometimes I feel like they verge on idealism, but they're not. I know they're not, but that's how it feels, you know, to really put it into practice. And we live in such a dangerous time right now. And you could see how the things could really spin out of control, how righteous anger on either side could really turn the situation into a cauldron, a burning cauldron, a hell, like Shanti Deva says. So that's what I'm working with.
So Sansen, you started by saying something about how situations where you need to be angry.
Yeah.
Can you dig into that a little bit?
I am patient, at least superficially, to a fault. I worked 31 years in an inner city school, and there were times when I was patient and not angry just to keep the peace. Situations when I should have spoken up. And, you know, in reflection, I think I was at times just a wimp, you know, because I didn't speak up about that bad teacher or not, you know, someone who didn't have classroom management or was, you know, maybe not doing things correctly because I was afraid to cause a conflict. I don't know if, well, there's so many examples. Of course, you know, in this conversation, I just keep thinking of the extremes. I shared with my partner this Christian fundamentalist who says Kamala Harris is a witch and that she's practicing occult arts. The occult is helping her win over people. Now, shouldn't we be angry about that? This is true. I'm not making that up.
I'm so glad that you're bringing this up because I resonate completely with what you're saying. And this is exactly the realm where I'm like, are you kidding? And I think it's such an important moment to say, like, patience does not mean passivity. Patience does not mean we should not act or not respond. But hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By compassion alone is hatred appeased. This is an eternal law, right? That's Shakyamuni Buddha, and it's true. And so it is, it's a really tall order. And then we as practitioners have to do the work of discovering, like, okay, how do I use my anger as like a flare that's sending me a message? This is wrong and I need to respond. And then what's the skillful response, right? I mean, you said yourself, if you go and like do the thing to the guy who's calling, like, we can look out and see where that kind of response has gotten us. So yeah, it is a really tall order not to respond to aggression with more aggression. And, you know, would that there were a playbook that said, here's what you do in each of these cases. Damn, there's not. You have vows, intention, noble friends, And each one of us has to decide and discern and learn, like, what does it mean in this case? What does that patience look like? And I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of opportunities, no matter how things go down. Ayo.
I can feel in the way you're expressing yourself that you're not afraid to feel anger and recognize it. And when you talk about, are you talking about the way of the Bodhisattva when you reference Shanti Devi?
Yes, yes.
So then I think about heroic perseverance and patience. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the similarities and differences between the patience that you're talking about and the heroic perseverance that Shanti Devi is talking about. Because the way of the Bodhisattva, as I understand it, uses all of these emotions to redirect our activities towards liberation.
Thank you for that. I mean, I think you just kind of gave us the condensed. Yeah. Yeah.
See that.
Yeah.
The clarity that comes from recognizing anger.
Right. So there is an energy that's rising up. And so our job is not to, I mean, we were, you know, wanting to underscore certain things that we can mistake for patience and that aren't patience. Come on in. Yes. Destiny and Hoodie in the house. Okay, great. Welcome. Go ahead.
Yeah, can I wanted to come back to Sanzen and you know, so I mean you would turn to the word hatred, right? And I think Pema Chodron quotes the Dalai Lama and says, you know, that he makes that distinction, right? And that you acknowledging that in anger can come from caring. Not sure that's quite what us hearing, and you know, there can be compassion in anger, or it can be turned to compassion, right? And hatred has ill will in it. Right. And so that might be a place to really pay attention. Right. The ill will is not that that's compounding hatred. Right. But even in anger, I think, it's Shanti Devi's teachings are radical. It's like it's hard. Right. But And I think of Dido, you know, and how he used to talk about anger. And I was never sure, actually, you know. And so, just like, have you ever experienced anger that actually was clean, right? That didn't hurt yourself or someone else. I don't know. I think it's worth really studying that. And so that, you know, there is the teaching, and then always like to examine it for ourselves. Right. And so not to deny the care, you know, not to deny the caring part of it. Right. So it is not passive, and you are sharing ways in which you may have thought you were being patient and you weren't being patient. Right. That's important, right? That we're learning what is actually being patient. It's not passive. Right, it's not turning it in on ourselves, right? If we're not actually letting go, right, then it's not patience, right? You know, if there is resentment that we carry with us, then we haven't been patient, right? We've like somehow turned it in on ourselves.
Does patience require energy?
So you asked, does patience require an action? Well, can you give him the mic? Can you say more?
Well, what you were just saying, that there's a difference between just not acting and glossing over things and true patience.
Well, I was, I'd say it depends on the situation. And it's also sort of like how are we able to work? So like, I think I heard Tosho saying, you know, she saw that she was angry or upset and she could have acted then, but she waited. There's a wisdom in that, right? Shanti Davis says, be like a piece of wood, don't act. Maybe he meant don't act yet, right? It's like, sometimes I've learned to do this with email. Like I get an upsetting email, don't respond yet, right? I have to respond, right? But when I respond from this, right, it doesn't go well, right?
I just go back because I feel like I didn't quite get to finish responding to what you brought up, Ayo, and I think it's a really good point, which just to sort of be succinct about it, I think we need to feel our feelings, right? And so what you were saying, like not being afraid to feel anger, so anger arising and not acting from anger, there's still energy that's moving through the body. And if we shut that down or cut it off or pretend it's not there, deny it's not there, then we can get sick from that. So is there a way to contain, in other words, allow ourselves to have the full experience of our anger or our wrath, but not act from that place? And you mentioned the perseverance or joyful effort. Yeah, for sure. That anger is our vital life force energy. And so when we can not lash out, but let that energy move through, and that kind of self-centered, other-centered quality that might be imbuing it dissipate, then we've got a lot of energy to work with, to respond in a different way. You know, that's like, very, very powerful in the human realm. Yeah.
Mac and then Tosho and then Kozen.
Oh, I definitely forgot what I was going to say. I'm sorry.
Okay.
This territory is what I comment on a lot and I'm familiar with. You know, I was married for quite some time to a person that in our culture we say is from the other side. You know, is a Trumper, is ultra conservative. But when you love the other person, all those dynamics are still there. Like we know how to push each other's buttons politically. I know what I can say but ultimately, do you want this person you love to be angry? Do you really want them to be angry? You know, when Obama won and my husband was crestfallen and really upset about what's going to happen to the country, I could remember having those same feelings when Bush won before. And the question becomes, how do you comfort the person you love, who's now like, just like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And you say, we're going to make it through. We're going to be okay. We're going to figure this out. The love connects. The love means you're going to wake up with this person as part of your world and what how do you move forward? If the person shouting asshole at you, if you're in love with them, if you're in a relationship of love, you got to figure out how you work this out. Because, you know, you can imagine a partner just saying, you asshole, right? And you're getting upset. But this is a person you're going to have to build a world with, and that you go wake up next morning and have to work with. Ultimately, that's true of the world, right? If you extend that metaphor outward, those are the tool sets that I use.
Thank you.
I was wondering, since we're not the first ones to come into this, what images that come up to my mind is when I was going to school and we'd see these images of those people working with Dr. Martin Luther King, how they were brutally, fire hose was used against them, the dogs would be set against them. And I've never really heard how he worked with those people to help them deal with what they might have as a righteous anger toward the people doing that. But I never heard of them responding negatively. And I'm thinking of how the Tibetans, when their Chinese took over, I heard a Tibetan say the worst thing I feared was getting angry. And I didn't know if, or Thich Nhat Hanh during the Vietnam War, the people were working with him, or Gandhi, all these people were pacifists, and they were very strong. And they somehow dealt with it. And I wonder if there's any parallels. Dr. Martin Luther King wasn't Buddhist, but I would think there'd be some similarities. And I've never really heard how an encounter or account of how they actually did with those terrible situations when there was a lot of reasons for them to have a lot of anger and fight back. But I never really heard that they did. Their practice was... didn't fight back or didn't attack back. And I've never really heard anything about what they did to try to encourage or foster them, not having that ruin them, but not going against fighting back and hurting others out of that anger.
Serious training in nonviolence. Yeah, and a deep tradition, drawing on a deep tradition of spiritual teachings on love. Yeah, very, very, lots of overlap, I would say.
I think it'd have to be worked again and again and again, you know, to keep on emphasizing that and practicing and putting a lot of energy into that, because I can't imagine some of the things that people have gone through and they somehow get through it without being destroyed.
Yes.
Anger and irritation are a form of energy that requires, by necessity, kind of something to push against. Like there's a self and an other that is, so there's an other that is the problem, and that is the thing to be fought and pushed against. And without having that other, it's hard to manufacture that energy, which often leads to just for me, a helplessness. If there's not something to push against, then there's a hole to sink into. And knowing that I don't want to find something to push against, I don't want to try to learn to become angry or irritated, but yet the energy needs to come from somewhere. Can anger and irritation be skipped, or do they need to be learned? I it feels strange for me to think, do I need to learn to be angry? But I haven't yet found a way to bring up energy without feeling like I would need to find something to push against, and that's difficult.
And do you mean push against in with anger?
Not even anger doesn't come to me naturally. I don't. I don't understand.
You don't understand my question?
No.
Well, I thought I understood you to be saying that was the pushing against.
Yeah, that's what anger would be.
Yeah.
It'd be an energy produced by like a friction, like a tension that creates something that can be transmuted, but if it doesn't exist in the first place, then what's transmuted? What do I mean?
The energy is always there. Okay. The energy is there. People's karma is different. So we can like involute the energy and like lock it up and sort of like have a more of a like depressive manifestation of our kleshas for sure. And I don't think that you should use anger to cure that. I don't think it's necessary. Right. But some of the same things that Shantideva is speaking about here in terms of there's a story. There's a story that can be subtle and underneath the surface. There's a feeling, right? So with energy, we're talking about a hot feeling. You're saying like friction, you can feel it, you can press against it. It's really palpable. And then we have our understanding of it and a story that's connected to it. And something that's more subtle or apparently more subtle, like a lack of energy, an apathy, a depression, it seems like there's not energy there. And it seems like maybe the story is quieter, but it's totally there. And that same quality of mindful attention, non-judgmental, mindful attention, like really looking and really seeing like what are we telling ourselves about this energetic state? And can we release the story and just come into direct contact in the moment with that experience without hating it, without trying to fix it, without really even knowing what it is, just as an experience? When I asked earlier, I think, why is that feeling difficult, you know? And Dio said, it's unpleasant. Like even then, you know, there's a way to sort of like go back and like, can we practice suspending judgment, even of pleasant and unpleasant, and just meet our arising energetic karmic experience on its own terms? Because when we get in there and we judge and we try and manipulate or we try and fix and cure, sometimes that's helpful, but often we're just creating more tangle. And that release that, you know, the Dyson's point about like, where does it go? That comes when we cease the activity. This is actually a perfect moment to practice patience in the deepest sense of non-doing, non-interference. Patience at the deepest level is rooted in trust. It's trust in reality. It's trust in your Buddha nature. It's trust in practice. You have to be awake totally. And then like, don't mess and forbear, because it's going to be really uncomfortable. And like, things can surprise you. What you thought it is, isn't.
And I also just to learn that we don't have to struggle. It's like we're so used to struggling in some way. That's what I heard. What I heard you saying, you know, like you don't have to have something to push against. But we are so used to pushing against something, which is usually our own suffering in some form, that it's like when we let that go, I experienced that regularly in Sesshin. And it's like, now what? And it's like, no, relax. It's okay.
Hey, this was sort of in response to the asshole comment, but it just sort of, it just came up for me. It was a memory. I was in Egypt more than, I think, 11, 12 years ago, and I was walking with this guy, and I had met him a little while ago, and he turns to someone who walked by, and he starts speaking at him in Arabic, like very forcefully. And I was like, what just happened? Like, what was that? And he was like, I didn't like that guy wronged me. And I was reading the Quran at him, and he was just quoting it right at him. And it was like a real like bang, bang thing. It's like this person started walking by. He's just, that's what he goes to. And it, I just thought of that as like an expression of anger, patience, peace, whatever you want to call it. Just something that's in just, it was so bang, bang. I remember like wrote it in my journal, and it's still so clear for me of like, that's how this man is responding to this moment.
You could start chanting the Heart Sutra, right?
but only if it's bang, bang, only if it's like right there. And actually a related thing, just from an Indian perspective, patience is such a strange, has always been such a strange translation of Shanti for me. Like Shanti is what is like chanted at the end of Hindu. And there's differences. It's a different, you know, like Hinduism, Buddhism are different, but Shanti, at least my parents always told me, was peace. It's another way into it. That I don't know, just another translation, I guess.
Thank you for that. I didn't actually make that connection between Shanti and Shanti with the K in front of it.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, Shanti Deva.
Yeah.
I don't think he was the patience god, you know?
Yeah, peace. Wow, thank you. Yeah.
Can we have a little, are we going to skip our last section?
I think we can do it in 2 minutes.
Okay.
I had my hell week in Outward Bound when I was an instructor my first year there, and I was with this awesome lead instructor, and I learned so much from the support teacher that was out with us and 12 kids, just the three of us adults along with all of these mini adults, and he just seemed to have this like codex, put the pain in your pink. And it was like, and I'm whipping my head around because I've just never heard it like framed in that way. He was just offering these kids some wisdom about baking that pain and using it where they could do it skillfully. And he used it, like some of the kids were chess players. And he's like, you're just throwing the pieces at each other instead of playing the game. And I really resonated with that. I still use that. I spend a lot of pain from my pink on that cushion. I think what's really allowed me to be vulnerable is the way he framed how to be open and in that way of like, hey, why are you showing your belly? It's because what you believe is true. Yeah, well then your belly's made of iron, so don't be afraid to show your belly. And I watched it, like that support teacher had to leave, and I watched these kids I'm not saying it as skillfully as he did, you know, with the connection that he had, but I had a kid that had like broken his ankle, right? On course, 6 days in, we have a 2 mile hike out of the woods, and we have to litter carry this 12 year old out of the forest. And the support teacher had to leave. He had to leave like a little bit earlier in the week. And I watched these kids use the codex that they were given to support their friend. and they were kind of tearing at each other all week. And with the presence of that, of their friend actually being in real pain, it all melted away so fast. I thought something else was going on. I thought something else was sort of wrong, right? Like, so that really resonated with me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very shocked, because that's the story from the sutra. So I just repeat it. So I, there's a story that, you know, a guy, when Buddha was giving a talk, and the guy just rushed to him and slapped his face. And at that time, the Shariputra, if I remember right, and just react and to push that guy away. And after that, Shariputra said, "Buddha, that guy just slapped your face. How come you're still so calm?" And Buddha said, "I'm angry with you, actually, because that guy, he slapped me. He got his reason. You know, maybe he was, you know, unhappy or something, you know, something he thought that I did something wrong, that so he came to, you know, do that to me." And so this story just stayed with me, that when we react something from our own point of the view, that I'm right. You know, that guy, how come, you know, how come you come to attack my teacher? And he is the Buddha, right? So the different point of view that we stand, and there's a lot behind that things we don't know. And so I think that's Buddha's patience. And, you know, I am still thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
That's good. That's helpful.
Okay, last section, patience along the path. It's a long path. It's not easy. Please be patient.
And it is an urgent matter. And so not to like there and to allow that tension. And so last week we were talking about cultivating bodhicitta, like cultivate your bodhicitta. You have to do something, you have to take care of it, this, your life. Right? And it takes time. And it doesn't happen the way we want it to happen. Doesn't never unfolds the way you think it's going to unfold. It never looks the way you think it's going to look. And be patient with ourselves along the path. And so to be gentle with ourselves along the path.
I sometimes, particularly this week preparing for this, was so struck by how Zazen practice itself is like, can just be an embodied practice of patience in that very deep sense of just letting yourself be with yourself and all things just as they are.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody.